Hi, this is Chris Evans, and we're recording another Storage Unpacked podcast today with Gavin and Martin. Hi, guys.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, Chris.
How are we doing?
Not bad, not bad.
It's been a busy week, but all good.
We're almost out of January, so that's a good sign, isn't it? So this week we've got Rob Peglar with us, and Rob is the, I think you're senior VP and CTO at Symbolic.io, Rob. Is that correct?
That's right, Chris. Appreciate you guys having me on.
Looking forward to it. We thought it would be good to get you on to chat about persistent memory, because that's something that has come up in conversation online and other formats, I think blog posts actually. And I know that you responded to that, and you've done some stuff recently on behalf of SNEAR and I think at a Tech Field Day. And we thought it'd be really good just to get you on and just talk through what persistent memory means in terms of that definition and fill in the gaps for people who perhaps are not entirely familiar with the technology and what it can do. So why don't you give us a definition, and that would be a good starting point.
Good. I'll be happy to do that. And I'll refer to, as you mentioned, Chris, quite a bit, the SNEA definitions and the work that's going on. I have a seat on the board of directors of the SNEA. I have for a while. It's a great organization, but won't go into detail about the organization itself. But we do have a fairly crisp definition of persistent memory. And that is, number one, accessible by a CPU, and number two, has the characteristic of byte addressability, and of course is persistent, as the name implies. So persistence, CPU accessible, byte addressable. That's what the SNEA has defined as persistent memory.
Okay, so by CPU, by being connected to the CPU, we mean it, potentially it's sitting in a DIMM slot on the memory bus of a server.
That's correct. That, in fact, that's the most common form today, but very happy to think of it that way, as memory in a DIMM slot. Right.
Okay. I think that's quite a nice definition, calling it that, because then people can sort of, I guess, visually, physically sort of see what that really means.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So why would I bother using it?
Why? that's the question. So why would you bother using it? There's a number of answers to that. So I'll give you a little spectrum of answers, if you like, and we can go further into one as you see fit. So number one, you know, for literally decades now, we've been used to volatile or non-persistent memory in DIMM slots and the DRAM technology in particular, although there were forms of volatile memory before DRAM, but let's limit it to that, the last 30 years or so. And of course, as systems designers or as application designers, we're all used to now the contents of that memory space literally disappearing on power loss. So when you shut your laptop off or your server crashes or what have you, we are all conditioned to have to reload data into memory, typically from a disk of some form, some non-volatile memory. So persistent memory, right off the bat, I think changes systems design, or potentially does, because now those contents are saved across a power loss. And in particular, using an external energy source such as a supercapacitor or sets of them to persist the data. So that's kind of general use case number one, is literally saving the contents of memory across a power loss. And one could go off on tangents on what that might be applicable to. Think about hypervisors and file systems and metadata retention and whatnot. So there's a lot of cases there. But that's kind of at the system level. At the application level, on the other hand, the benefit that I see, and we've seen now for almost 3 years with non-volatile DIMMs, are the ability to access memory using it under storage semantics, as well as CPU semantics, and literally turn IOs now into CPU load stores, so the application gets the benefit of being able to read its data in a persistent state, mind you, across the CPU bus, which we commonly know as DDR4, at least in a server. So the latency now is much reduced over quite literally any other form of persistent media that might sit on a PCI Express bus. So the benefit for applications is speed, in addition to persisting across power loss, and then the benefit for systems at large is the ability to know that the data is there, again, even across power loss, and the implications on systems design.
Why can't I just stick a big battery on my DIMMs?
Why can't you just do that? Well, in in days gone by, that indeed was done. And what we had was this hybrid called non-volatile RAM, or NVRAM for short. And there were other forms of NVRAM as well, but battery-backed RAM DIMMs, or battery-backed DRAM DIMMs in particular, were there. But the control thereof was never standardized. So you're kind of on your own as a designer. There was no worldwide standard on how to do that. Now, about 2 years ago, the standards body known as JEDEC, J-E-D-E-C, which controls a number of technologies, and in particular memory DIMMs for our discussion, standardized the method in which you literally could attach a battery, or now more commonly supercapacitors. Batteries are falling out of favor somewhat, mostly because of the chemistry and the volatility, pun intended, of a battery. But supercaps, on the other hand, can provide that source. And now there's a standardized way to invoke that energy source on a DIMM and what we call a non-volatile DIMM.
So I think the answer there was, Martin, obviously you could, but it's not the right way to do it anymore. And that, I guess, leads us on to, you mentioned JEDEC, and
right.
I think there are now a number of standards that have been established around different types of NV DIMM.
That's right. That's right. There are actually three different types, and they're distinguished by a letter, in particular, the type F, the type N, and the type P. Now, the type N is by far the most popular and actually has been available on the market in various capacities now for, well, going on 3 years. Started out quite small at 8 gigabytes per DIMM and now is 16 and 32. And those numbers, by the way, represent both the capacity of the DRAM half of the NVDIMM-N, as well as the NAND, or non-volatile half, of the -N part. The NVDIMM-N is quite literally a hybrid. It's half DRAM, half NAND. But and then it has, again, the control mechanisms built in to allow the system to invoke the triggering, if you like, of the external energy source and thus be able to move the contents of the DRAM into the NAND and then vice versa on power up. Confusingly enough, some of the industry calls this backup and restore, and it is a form of that. Anyway, long story short, NVDIMM-N is quite popular. There is a number of vendors that are offering that and a number of OEMs, server manufacturers that are now beginning to in turn offer NVDIMM technology as part of their server offerings.
Just to fill that out a second or two, because there's a few questions that come up there.
Right.
So it sounds to me like most of the I/O is served out of DRAM on board of that card until we have a power issue, and in which case what we're doing is effectively vaulting that memory onto NAND so that we can bring it back when the power comes back.
That's exactly correct. In fact, every interaction with an NVDIMM-N is to DRAM. When that machine is powered up, and by the way, the BIOS and firmware must be modified to recognize the NVDIMM, but let's assume they are. And what you see is a DRAM area, but it's also marked as a persistent area with the mechanism that you just very well described. So it is a slightly different form in terms of how the operating system deals with it, but that's exactly right. You're dealing with DRAM and only DRAM, and the NAND comes into play only on power loss.
Okay, so what's next? Which is the next one?
So the next one is called the -F, and it's kind of F for flash. Now, the -F was actually in history the first type of NVDIMM to appear. It is all NAND, or all non-volatile memory. It doesn't have to be NAND. I'll talk about crosspoint in a minute. But it is all NAND, no DRAM. And then there is a specialized controller on the DIMM itself, which translates the memory bus signals, DDR4 in particular, into NAND block addressable nomenclature. Remember, NAND by itself is not byte addressable, so there's this controller layer in between. Now, there were NVDIMM-F on the market, but just recently, they have fallen out of favor, and I don't personally know of any more vendors or manufacturers which are making the NVDIMM-F in its pure form, which is all non-volatile. So although that is standardized, there's no entrance for that?
So the first thing that springs to mind there from my perspective is there's an issue in terms of how you do that translation layer, because if you were updating individual bytes, somehow you've got to protect the NAND and not damage it, because continuing to rewrite the same block every time is not going to be hugely efficient.
That's correct. Yeah, there are a number of kind of internal issues in dealing with NAND and yet making it appear as a byte addressable, CPU accessible resource. So you have actually hit on one of several of them.
Let's keep moving. So P then.
Right. The last form is called a dash P. And that too is a hybrid of DRAM and NAND. But in general, and again, the dash P is standardized. And there are vendors which are in research and development with dash P offerings. Some are closer to market than others. But typically a fairly small amount of DRAM coupled with a fairly large amount of NAND. In fact, quite a bit larger than you would find on an NVDIMM-N. For example, and it's only an example, you might see an 8 or 16 gigabyte DRAM portion followed by a 128 or possibly even 256 gigabyte NAND portion. Now again, the difference in the dash P is that while the DRAM is certainly accessible on the memory bus, there is also a controller which can bring the NAND into play while the DIMM is powered on, as opposed to the dash N, where the NAND only comes into play to guarantee persistence across power loss.
Okay, so those are very different designs and use cases, and it's possibly confusing for people to know which one would be more beneficial for them than others. Is there any sort of way to help people understand what they should be choosing the different ones for?
Well, there is, and in fact, it's... It's fairly straightforward today because quite literally there are only dash N devices on the market, which are, and again, they have been on the market for over 2 years now. Now, I suspect, and this is just, you know, an industry guess, if you like, that the dash P will begin to appear later this year, 2018, and then into 2019, which brings us into other non-standard forms of non-volatile DIMMs, such as those which have been announced by Intel, made of 3D crosspoint material. But that's a whole nother section. Those aren't JEDEC NVDIMMs, strictly speaking. We'll see what kind of standardization comes out, if any, for those type of non-volatile devices.
That's an interesting one because obviously Optane is a more persistent media, or is persistent.
Correct.
It's not like a DRAM, but it's faster, and therefore it doesn't necessarily need to be treated the same way as you treat NAND. So I guess that does sort of question whether that might turn out to be its own definition in its own right.
That's right. Yeah. 3D crosspoint in particular is byte addressable from the get-go, as well as block addressable, depending on the controller that you put in front of it. So yeah, the SSDs are on the market now with this material, as you mentioned, under the Optane brand. The goal for us, at least systems designers in persistent memory, as defined by SNIA, is to use that material directly from the CPU, memory bus, byte addressable, and albeit slower than DRAM, the possibility for greater density is there as well, and again, in DIMM form.
So the rumors are in the industry that's going to be a little bit late from Intel at the moment.
Yeah, Martin, that's what I'm hearing as well. And we, like a number of other firms, are waiting for the release of that. We know that some people under OEM agreement and NDA have DIMMs, but again, they're in research and development mode. There's no public support for it yet. And again, it's Intel's roadmap as to which of their processors will actually support 3D crosspoint on a memory bus.
Well, they've got to fix those first anyway, haven't they, Rob?
Yeah, that's right. They've got some work to do.
Yeah.
So you bring up a good point there, Martin, actually, and that's that. I guess we'll move on to next, and that's, and on the one hand, it's support in terms of the chipset or the processor, and then support within the operating system. Rob, you briefly mentioned that support is needed from the BIOS and potentially the hardware. Is it a chipset thing that needs to be changed as well, or is that likely? Is it just the BIOS in the actual server?
It's the latter, Chris. Yes, the BIOS, again, there are already platforms that have adapted the BIOS to recognize at power on the leverage that one needs to identify an NVDIMM. They have a special BIOS table type. So then the BIOS, of course, dutifully reports said NVDIMMs up to the bootloader and the operating system. So you have this, you know, reverse stack, if you like, starting at the bottom and then rippling all the way up The operating system has to recognize that it's a different area. Although it is DRAM, it now has the characteristic of persistence. So the OSs have evolved over time. Some of the OSs have better support than others, but several of them, Linux and Windows in particular, have had support for NVDIMMs for a few years now, although just getting adopted into the world. And then the question is, okay, how can applications take advantage of that? But yes, you do have to have this chain of support. Now, beginning with the CPUs, they're of course adaptable to DRAM, and the DRAM on these NVDIMM-Ns is standardized, so the hardware itself doesn't have any problem with it, the CPUs in particular, but it's the firmware, starting at the BIOS and then rippling all the way up, that has to recognize it in order to take advantage of it.
So what would happen if somebody bought some and stuck them in a server that didn't have a BIOS update for that?
Well, what you might see, and again, depending on the BIOS, is you would see a very small DRAM DIMM appearing in a DIMM slot, and that would be that. You'd never be able to persist the data. You'd never be able to invoke the JEDEC standardized power sequence if power happened to go out. So you would effectively have a very small DRAM DIMM.
So you're right. I think in terms of support, I believe Linux kernel 4.14, I think, and Windows 2016 onwards. Well, I think the two operating systems right. That came to mind that I looked at. But I'll double check it, and I'll stick it in the show notes just for people, so there's a bit of additional background there.
Yep.
Okay, great. Now, let's talk about application usage, because sure. You briefly touched on it at the very beginning there. I've seen some stuff online that Microsoft have done where they've shown how the NVDIMM devices could be used in support of a file system to protect the metadata to make file systems work more effectively.
Right.
I mean, that just sounds like one example, but it must be a much wider range of things.
Oh, I think there is. There's, I think, in my mind, several different application areas, if you like, that can take advantage of persistent memory. You mentioned one of them, file systems. Again, this is more of a systems level design. Certainly, preservation of metadata is important, but also the sheer reduction in latency, especially if your file system can be what we call persistent memory aware, or PM-aware, as you might see on a SNIA slide, and then can access that memory directly using memory semantics as opposed to, you know, POSIX I/O read-write semantics. So there's a number of variations there in between, but certainly file systems can take advantage. Now, I think a very ripe area for application adoption is actually in the area of databases, and in particular, the notion that we've had for, again, literally decades, that a database must have very large RAM buffers in order to read either metadata or tables or other key, you know, logs or other key areas that you might run in a transactional database. And that's literally because no one can guarantee the persistence of the data in DRAM. So databases for decades have gone to great lengths to design to this. Now, I think databases, and again, this will take some time, but databases can take advantage of persistent memory in their own structures, not just for, again, you know, key value metadata preservation, but also taking advantage of the fact that now they no longer have to read data from disk. The data is present in persistent memory or a portion thereof, which can be accessed directly from the CPU by load store mechanism rather than read write. So there's some redesign involved, but I think it's quite a bit well worth it to get reduction of latencies, you know, 10 or 100 fold in database transactions. That's one area. Another area is the processing of data for analytic purposes. Again, there's kind of batch mode and streaming mode. You might think of it as Apache Hadoop and Apache Spark. But again, if my data set is entirely in memory, which has been, you know, finding favor recently, you know, the so-called in-memory computing, I like to say, if your data isn't in memory, guess what? You're not computing. You're actually waiting. But that's a sidebar. But the ability to persist that data over time, even across power loss, and use the analytic software tools at hand, perhaps in conjunction with larger data sets that might be on an SSD or even a rotating drive of some form. But having that data set in memory, and then if you have systems which can take advantage of actually reducing the data in memory, you have an even bigger win. I think the analytic world, and this gets us into machine learning and artificial intelligence algorithms and deep neural nets and all sorts of interesting things, again, which are very memory dependent. The CPU wants to access it as fast as they can.
Yeah, I think from my perspective, I would look at it and think that, as you said, anything you can, if you can bring the whole data set into memory, that's good. But you can bring the whole data set into memory with DRAM. The benefit is if you're checkpointing it and doing updates and producing stuff from it, if you're manipulating that data or in some way changing it, you're not having to commit to an external persistent source in order to keep going, and that ends up slowing you down. I think that's the bit where I can see some advantage.
Is that really true? Because I was thinking one of the things, so the way Rob's described it, me using is really as a read cache. Whereas if you're writing stuff, if you're depending how your database or the data store is designed, you're designing for availability, you need some kind of shared storage layer. Now, is that going to be the persistent memory, or is it going to go to some external device?
No, that Martin, that's a great question. I'll take a whack at that one. So I think, again, in terms of, you know, the databases that might use a common form of, you know, two-phase commit, something like that, because there's a volatile area and which is being fed to a non-volatile area. Now, if you think of that in terms of persistent memory, quite literally, I can get guaranteed commit in one phase, and that is quite literally a CPU store mechanism. Now, to your point, if you wanted to use persistent memory as a block device, so to do the traditional read-write POSIX-style I/O to it, you certainly can. There's a number of libraries and, again, OS support for using it as a block device, and several companies and applications have taken that step to, instead of, you know, using an SSD, for example, on the PCI Express bus, now they're using NVDIMM in block mode and treating it like an I/O device as opposed to a memory device, which is byte accessible. So you can really have it either way. Now, I think personally, as an architect, I think we will see more forms and more applications tend to use the byte addressable capability of persistent memory. Perhaps, I won't say as opposed to, but perhaps in addition to looking to do that block level commit, as you mentioned, but only on a very fast DDR4 type device, as opposed to a solid state device sitting on a PCI Express bus.
Yeah, I can certainly see it's much more applicable in a NoSQL type environment where you've got right. Eventually consistent databases. Your traditional relational database is still going to want a consistent store at the back, so you can use traditional failover techniques. But I can see it in a NoSQL, a Cassandra or a Mongo, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Would be incredibly
mm-hmm.
powerful.
Very good.
We could probably spend another half an hour talking about the application usage and how we could employ it. Because I think that's where it becomes really interesting. And I think perhaps we should shelve that for another podcast, because that we could talk about that completely. But just to finish that particular section off, Rob, are you using it within your platform?
We are. We have been using NVDIMM-N in particular for quite some time, over 2 years now, and continue to develop that around that, and have, very successfully engineered that. Had to do a lot of work because we were very early on that, but now that we're there, it's going very, very well. And then, of course, looking to additional forms of persistent memory as the SNIA defines it. And if we see some in 2018, that's great. We'll use it straight away. But I think 2019, 2020, more in particular, we will see not just one form, but perhaps several forms of new types of persistent memory. And again, that's a whole podcast worthy by itself.
Yeah, absolutely. We don't want to overstimulate people with too much content in one go, do we? That's,
right.
That's part of the problem.
Very good.
Okay, so let's talk about customers a bit more. You're clearly a customer because you use it for your platform.
Right.
Do we know whether this is being used by the hyperscaler cloud vendors? Or, you know, is there a typical customer that would be out there? Is it going to be large enterprise? Because it seems to me it might be an expensive technology that's at the moment quite niche.
Well, it is, again, being a form of memory, it is higher on the expense scale, if you like, than block accessible non-volatile technology like NAND. So there's certainly that. Now, there are a number of efforts, my company included, into looking at how the data is organized in persistent memory for better efficiency. But stepping back, what we see now from an industry point of view is that several of the server manufacturers or server OEMs are customers for the handful of NVDIMM-N providers out there. And there may be more over time, but right now I actually count 5 or 6 of them. But be that as it may, so the OEMs are providing basic support for them. Again, they have to do BIOS updates, they have to do firmware updates. So the platform adoption of NVDIMM-N is perhaps slower than some would like. I think that will gain momentum as time goes by. And then I think once it's well understood, I think the hyperscalers may be able to use persistent memory in particular applications. Again, back to your applications discussion, they may have some of their server types, which are typically custom built for a particular app, leverage persistent memory, while others don't because of cost reasons. So I think it's going to be a mixed bag, but I do see adoption by the hyperscalers in certain applications that they see economic justification for.
The only question I had really, Rob, for you is a lot of this is going to require a different way of thinking. Anything that's bringing in new technology that you talked about, database design, about people taking advantage of this, is going to take a new way of thinking. And we know that history is littered with getting people to think about different architectures and taking advantage of this takes time. How long do you think it is really before, say, the database manufacturers use them as an example, or some of the other software providers really start thinking differently about how they can take advantage of this, i.e. when does it become mainstream?
No, that's a terrific question. And I'll give you an answer that I've used in other lectures or talks that I've given, and I call it the double Olympic cycle. So if you think of it in terms of 8 years from the very basic, you know, starting at, you know, year one or year zero, if you like, depending on how you count, the very basic, you know, introduction of the technology. Now, for NVDIMMs, we're in year three for that. I say the double Olympic cycle because if you look at the extremely large variation of software, you know, many different layers, many different applications, many different, you know, use cases even within a given application, like a NoSQL database, for example. The adoption of something fully into the mainstream in software where you don't have to think about it anymore, it's fully designed in, we understand it completely, I think that takes roughly 8 years to do. Now, that's kind of a number I use that has been borne out in history. But I am actually optimistic about persistent memory because some of the homework has already been done. Again, I think we're in year three. And the good part of this adoption curve is that, again, if you're of my vintage, for example, you actually remember persistent memory in systems and you help design systems with persistent memory. We called it CORE, and it was persistent across power loss. So the all the design techniques to leverage persistent memory are there, but they've been dormant for about 25 to 30 years. And they're now revving up again, and people are to your point, Gavin, starting to think differently. You see that activity in the Linux community in particular with pmem.io. There's already folks thinking about that. The OEM and the server platforms have picked it up. So from that level, there is now adoption. I wouldn't say mainstream yet, but it's there. So I am very optimistic that in the next 2 to 3 years, we'll see much wider adoption. And then mainstream might be out until 2022 or 23. Again, the double Olympic cycle.
Okay, that makes sense. Thanks.
That has been a fantastic introduction to the technology. I think, Rob, we've also given ourselves at least two topics to come back and have another conversation on.
Very good.
But for now, if people want to look at what you're doing, both as a company and follow you personally on Twitter or whatever, where can they find you?
That's right. I'm pretty active on Twitter. It's at PeglarR, so PEGLARR. That's on Twitter. I'm active on LinkedIn as well, so you can find me there. But I would also point your listeners to the SNEA website, snea.org, for all sorts of information. And again, the SNEA just hosted literally last week the Persistent Memory Summit, of which there are, count them, 9 hours of video. Maybe not all in one go, but pick and choose the parts that you want of that. So I would encourage people to look at the SNEA website. Again, kind of the industry standard resource for education and material on persistent memory.
That sounds great. I think there is a link, isn't there? www.snea.org/PM, I think is
that's the, right. I think it's right link. As well. Yep.
Okay, I'll double check it and I'll put it on the show notes.
Very good.
Well, that's been great. Thanks very much for joining us. And thanks to Gavin and Martin. And we'll catch everybody next time on another podcast.